Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to Book Cheat, the book club podcast where I've read the book so you don't have to. My name is Dave Warnicki, and on each episode of this show we look at one of the classics. And joining me to look at such a classic this week, it's the Lawman, James Shakeshaft and Alastair Beckett King. Hello!
Hello Dave.
How's it going?
Good, how are you?
I'm very well actually, thanks.
I'm just thrilled to be talking to Australia.
This is a fully international episode. I love it.
You're so far away. I got into the mood by listening to Savage Gardens all around me
just before we came on.
Because in 1997, the camp rap section in that was, I believe the kids say, my jam. That it was my jam.
Fantastic. Well, I've got some good news for you, and that is the singer of that band, Darren Hayes, is still going strong. I do some warm-up work for a TV show where he was a guest a few weeks ago, and there literal people almost passing out and crying when he was on the show, much like they did in 1997, but it's the same fans, and now they're all in their 40s. It was amazing to watch.
Is
nice.
He keeping well?
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah, it was fun. It was awesome to see that people still love him.
Well, I mean, Australia eventually had to produce something of value, and it did in Savage Garden.
Darren Hayes.
Sorry, what did I say, James? What was it? I'm in trouble.
My in preparation for this was just thinking about Neighbours forever.
All right. Any sort of white rap come out of Neighbours? I don't think so. Not to my knowledge.
No. Angry Anderson, I don't think he ever turned his hand to rap.
That's a shame.
That really is a shame.
Yeah.
That's a real shame.
I'm sure one of the Rebeccas must have. But yes, carry on.
Oh, Toady. I would have loved a Toady rap. I feel like...
The Toady rap!
There definitely is a Toady rap.
Maybe like a ska song with just a rap section in it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I feel like something Scar might be more appropriate.
If Jared Rebecca, a.k.a. Toadfish, a.k.a. Toady, were to release an album, I think it would be in that sort of William Shatner spoken kind of speak-singing kind of vibe. Have I told you about my mate's nan who was a little hard of hearing and thought that Toady was called Tony? She was an Irish lady. She was like, "Oh, that Tawny is such a naughty boy. What's Tawny up to now?"
So, he's Jared Tony Rebecca. That's what she was thinking. Why are they calling him Tony?
What's a tone fish anyway?
Oh, there must have been some sort of musical career at some stage.
So many have. Surely it would have been impossible to resist.
I'm looking him up now. Oh, he's been in musical theatre. He's been
of
in...
He has?
Yes, absolutely. He's been in Cinderella.
He must have spat some rhymes in his time, surely.
And you'll be very pleased to know that Down Under, we also have our own version of The Masked Singer, and he was on that last year.
Oh, what was he masked as?
Not sure I'm going to dive into a wiki here.
No, this is not the book
that
we're going to be studying, right?
No, it's not the book of Neighbours. It's not the book, but I feel like
it's not the Neighbours Annual 1986. Oh,
bring it back.
Put it back on the shelf then.
No, I've been listening to a bunch of your podcasts lately, and I absolutely love it. Lawman, it's fantastic. For people who haven't heard it before, what's it all about?
It's about local legends and obscure curiosities from days of yore.
Would those be from days of yore?
Yeah, those are from Days of Yore, actually.
Right. Thanks for clarifying.
Your past. Well, everyone's past. It's basically the weird little ghost stories or weird little legends that you kind of only know because you grew up in a particular place. For example, the headless ghost stuck... the headless ghost duck of Stoke.
Yeah. Most people don't know about that, except people who listen to our podcast who talk about it all the time.
You're spreading the good word.
I always tell people it's like, you know, like the legends like Loch Ness and Robin Hood. It's not those ones. It's not the ones that have had the Hollywood treatment. It's the ones that will never make it to Hollywood because there are just major plot holes in most cases. And James and I enjoy poking away at those plot holes.
The most recent one I listened to was one of your most recent episodes, Denizens of Another World, where it was basically, it was similar to a book cheat. There was a manuscript that had been found. Oh, I was hooked. I loved it. A man had seen a smaller alien craft, perhaps.
Yeah.
There was a fox. I don't want to give away too much, but that was a very funny section.
There was like a robot fox, I think, at one point. I'm terrible. I forget them as soon as...
I think there was an idea of a badger in armour was posited at one point, but it turned out to simply be an alien.
It was logical. It had a logical answer. Yes.
With my enormous relief, gentlemen, I inform you it was no badger, but a creature from outer space.
So I absolutely highly recommend that episode if people are looking for somewhere to start. Very, very funny stuff. And... Alistair, you've been very busy of late because it's great to have... Sometimes on this show, we invite authors, and today, that is you.
Is it? The arrogance of the man to have written a book. Oh, he thinks you need to read 200 pages of his thoughts. What an awful person.
Well, maybe in 100 or 200 years, there'll be someone like me coming along and summarising it for other people.
And essentially infringing on my copyright. Yeah, well, maybe.
Don't worry, I'll wait until you're long dead.
I mean, what an encouraging threat that is. Don't worry, you'll be long dead by the time I do that. I wrote a kid's book, and it came out last week. My publisher wants me to mention in Australia as well as the UK and Canada. And it's called... you can't... here, but I'm looking to the side so I can see the book to make sure I get the title right. It's called...
How long is it going to be?
It's called Montgomery Bonbon Murder at the Museum. I do know the name, but I do have to just check that I don't say in the museum by mistake.
Fantastic.
Oh, you've got a real Sex in the City, Sex in the City vibe there.
Yeah, yes, that is exactly the vibe I'm going for my book aimed at kids aged 8 to 12.
So it's a murder mystery?
It's a whodunit, a proper whodunit, with lots of jokes as well. There's a real murder, and there's real clues. It's a fair play murder mystery. So if you're paying attention, you've got a good chance of solving it. Maybe you will, maybe you won't. But it also has, hopefully, a whole load of gags and funny characters and pokes fun at the tropes of the genre.
Am I right in assuming then that you're a big fan of the genre?
I love a whodunit. I love a murder mystery.
Me too.
I just like it when posh people die and no other genre has devoted itself so consistently to horrible posh people being killed in studies.
And punished for their crimes.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, absolutely. It's like, oh, the cruel factory owner just invites all his mates around and says, I hate every single one of you. None of you are in the will. Now to go to a room on my own for an hour and lock the door from the inside. Click. And you're like, yes. It's the last we'll see of him.
Fantastic. So available in all good bookstores, even down under. Love that.
I mean, I can't say that it's in all bookshops. Australia is a big country. But it is available in bookshops.
And no, that's
it
why
is
I said
available in Australia.
All good bookstores, because good books, if they don't have it, they're no good. Leave.
They're awful. They're just terrible. Yeah.
So what you recommend is you go up to the person, ask if they've got it, they look it up on the computer, and then they haven't, and then you tip one of them tables on your way out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. They'll say like, we can order it in for you, and then you just want to be flipping tables over straight away before they even finish that sentence. Like, the we
cool, cool,
this,
cool.
This store recommends, boom, gone.
Recommends table legs.
Romance for Valentine's Day. Boom, gone, it's over.
Even if you've already got a copy, just keep going around and taking out the bookstores that don't have it.
Yep.
Word will get around. They'll know what to do.
Yeah, I'm planning a sort of a low-key gangster-style racket to encourage bookstores to be like, oh, you got a copy of the book? Oh, that's a shame. That's a real shame. This is a nice store. That's the kind of vibe I want to communicate.
Now, we're here today to talk about a Shakespeare play. Can you believe it?
William?
Oh, yeah.
William, sorry. Yes, I should say William.
William Shakespeare. Okay, just checking.
Just making sure.
Not one by his son.
Dave Shakespeare. I can't say Dave, you're called Dave. That's terrible. That's a terrible, what bad improvisation, just reading a word that is on the screen in front of me. It's really awful.
Microphone Shakespeare? Oh, fuck.
JFS Lawmen Podcast Shakespeare. No, come on. Original Sound for Musicians off Shakespeare. This is so bad.
No, it is the one and only William Shakespeare. I've been working my way. I think this might be about the 10th one we've done on the podcast. But we're still. He's got good ones left in the canon, so we're all good.
Is this one of them?
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Well, is it?
To let you know the kind of quality we're dealing with, I googled Shakespeare's best plays to see what was left, and we're in the top 10, baby. We're in the top 10.
Oh, thank goodness.
None of your Timon of Athens nonsense.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that one seven, he did about Henry VIII.
Seven guys from Barnsley, or whatever it was called.
That's next week. But this week we are talking about Much Ado About Nothing.
Oh. Well, listeners to our podcast will know I try to come across as very well read, and I'm ashamed to say that I haven't read this one.
And other listeners to our podcast will know I trained as an actor.
Because he never shuts up about it.
Yeah.
It's always coming
also
in.
Also went to mime school.
Why would you tell people you went to mime school? The one advantage of mime school is you learn to shut up.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's not good for the podcast medium, but I am doing some great mimes. Just trust that I'm doing some great mimes right now, walking into the wind to this microphone. I think I've been in that, Much Ado About Nothing.
Incredible.
So does that mean you know the story, James?
No. It means I might know one or two scenes that I was in. But I can't even remember what character I was, to be honest.
It's like when people are in a Hollywood movie and they only get given their two pages of dialogue so they don't spoil the script. So they only gave you your one scene, even though Shakespeare is widely available.
Well, no, I think what it is, to be honest, it's actors are a lazy lot. Yep. And what you do when you get your script and your part, you simply just look for your name, your character's name in the script, and highlight those bits. And those are the only bits you read. And I think maybe what it is like the modern day blockbusters, they've just realized it's not worth printing out the pages. They're actually doing a service to the environment by just giving people the scenes they're in.
Right.
Because you don't care what happens if you're not in it. You're an actor.
But surely, James, as an aspiring actor, you need to learn the whole play in case one of the lead actors hurts their ankle. And you can be like, I know that part.
Nah, riff it.
No? Just riff it.
Oh my God. I genuinely, one of my most common anxiety dreams is Shakespeare based. I'm about to go on stage for a Shakespeare play and I don't know what it is. And it turns out I've got the first line. And I just have to just riff it off the top of my head from context.
There's great power in that though. You get to choose which Shakespeare everyone else is doing. So you walk out there. You know a bunch of first lines, and they're like, oh no, we're doing Macbeth or whatever. You get to choose it. They've got a chance.
Macbeth scene three again.
Yeah. Yeah, you get out there and you start reciting RoboCop, and they've all just got to join you.
My three main protocols. Protect the innocent, uphold the law, etc.
Now, this play has been suggested by a few people. People write in, they tell me there's a form in the description of this episode if anyone wants to fill it out and tell me what books I should do. And then when I get to it, I'll say thank you. And these are the people that suggested Much Ado About Nothing. Thank you to Adora from London, Emma Lawler from Austin in Texas, Thomas Hill from Sheffield, Lyra from somewhere in the USA, Esme Aish-Leman, also from England, Mary Harrington from Phoenix, Arizona, and finally Darcy T from New Zealand. Thank you so much.
I don't want to insult those people specifically, obviously, as fans of your show, but I have to say, having not read it, the title doesn't grip me. Because the title is sort of like, oh, a load of pointless nonsense.
Yeah,
like, work a little bit harder on your titles.
From Shakespeare, isn't it?
Yes,
like,
it is.
He's got to the point where he can be like, any old fluff is what I'm going to call my next play. It's a bit of nonsense, isn't it? It's a bit of fun.
Yeah, just general stuff.
It's a Shakespeare play. You're going to come and see it.
Yeah, like a painter just painting it a canvas black and then saying, you'll pay for it.
Has it got a subtitle, by the way? They often do. Is it like Much Ado About Nothing or What You Will? Isn't that one of them?
That
might be Twelfth Night. One of them is generally called or whatever. Whatever, mate.
What,
I don't
what You
care.
Will is just like whatever you like. Whatever you like. Yeah. You call it what you want.
Yeah.
I'm not saying he was a good writer, but he just not great with titles.
He did give up on 12th Night or just Fill Your Boots, Mate. And the sniff is part of it. It's actually written in.
That's that little dagger symbol that you sometimes see. That's how you pronounce that in old books.
I'm not getting any subtitle here, so I think that's all it is. He left it there.
Oh, that's how lazy he was as a writer, that he didn't even give it two titles.
No. Just one. So it was believed to have been written in around 1598, first published in the First Folio in 1623, and I love how Encyclopaedia Britannica describes it. It says, quote, "The play takes an ancient theme, that of a woman falsely accused of unfaithfulness, to brilliant comedic heights." So thank you, Britannica, who finds that very funny. The title of the play, while we're talking about it, is actually a pun, which
longer
is it?
Makes sense. Because the word nothing in Shakespearean times was pronounced much like we say noting. And the plot is driven by characters overhearing each other, noting things down, and also taking note of each other. So it's Much Ado About Noting is what the pun's going for there.
Well, that's made it a lot worse in my eyes.
This is why we should always steer clear of puns. And,
to be fair, our podcast, Lawmen, it's a pun, and that it doesn't work. So I have a lot of sympathy for...
It was instantly out of date when we came up with that pun.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I say we because I'm trying to spread the blame around.
It's very, very bad for people whose accent... Who the word lawmen doesn't sound like lawmen in some people's accents. So we cause much confusion
Most
among Americans
people's.
And pirates, the two main categories of people who pronounce the letter R. The Irish as well.
According to your BBC, nothing...
Our BBC.
That's right, I'm putting that on you.
Britain's BBC, okay, all right.
Because nothing was also a euphemism in Elizabethan times referring to the female genitalia because thing... was Elizabethan slang derived from women having quote-unquote nothing between their legs. I love your culture. I love it.
That sounds
like a
no-tail.
Right, I see.
Sorry.
Is that a phrase, James, or did you just invent that?
A tail or a no-tail? I think it was popularised by League of Gentlemen.
As a
sort of a local way of discerning between the genitalias, the two main. Genitalia.
I've never heard that one before. I've heard mossy face.
Pardon.
From I think that's 18th century.
A motty face.
Mossy, like on a rock.
Oh,
like moss.
I see. Right. Which one's that?
That's the nothing. That's the
oath.
Right.
Yeah, that one.
Now I always start with the opening line of the novel or play, and in this case, it is. Act 1, Scene 1, before Leonardo's house. And I'll give you the opening line here from Leonardo, which is, "I learn in this letter that Don Peter of Aragon comes this night to Messina." And we're off.
Exposition. Boom. Good exposition. Just get right into the story,
straight in.
I think. Mm. usually, you know, so is Leonardo a main character? Because usually Shakespeare plays start with like two servants describing everybody who you're about to see.
Yes.
And they'll be like, oh, the master and the mistress have been talking and plotting and, oh, here they come. And then those guys, you just never see them again. They were just there to do setup.
He's Leonardo. He's a main character, but he also is there to do the setup because we've met him. He's the governor of the Italian town of Messina, which is funny because in Australia, that's a famous chain of gourmet ice cream parlors. So he is the governor of ice cream that's flavored like, you know, pancakes and potato chips and strange things like that. Most of the play is set in and around his large home or parlor. And at the start of the play, a messenger, this is the exposition part, has just told him that they're saying that some old friends are dropping by on their way back from a battle. So that's the people he's learned are coming. The group is led by Don Pedro, a prince of Aragon, who has just halted a rebellion from his illegitimate brother, Don John.
What a disappointing name. Don John.
Don John.
Don John.
Don John and John Peter.
Yeah, so it's kind of confusing because they that one's sort of the good guy, one's the bad guy. Don Pedro and Don John, the bad guy.
Oh, what a great name for a bad guy, John. Don John. That really, it really zings off the page. Yeah. So they're Spanish, or what we would now call Spanish, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. The Kingdom of Aragon.
Visiting the town of Baskin-Robbins in Italy. Good. I'm on. I'm following. Yeah.
Great.
As long as I understand.
So Don Pedro is still on top because he's defeated his illegitimate brother Don John. And he's traveling to Messina. And he's got a soldier with him named Claudio that has won great respect for his exploits on the battlefield. And another soldier and friend is with him. His name is Lord Benedick.
Oh, not bothering with the T.
No T.
Just it's bailing out on the name Benedict far too early in my view.
Benedict, D-I-C-K is how it's spelled. I've never heard that name before. And when you search it online, he's the only one that comes up. Was he the Beyonce or the prince of his day? I don't know.
Was he, because Bene means good. Was he Benedict by nature as well as by name?
Well, I'm wondering if it is a bit of nominative determinism because he's kind of an arrogant guy that you don't like too much at the start of the play. He is a bit of a Benedick.
Has he got a sister called... Has he a sister called Ben or Nothing?
Known as Mossy Face. So, that's the three of them. There's Don Pedro. He's there with Claudio, great soldier, and Lord Benedick. And they are visiting Governor Leonardo, who also has his own little posse that contains himself, his daughter...
Raphael?
I'm sorry to disappoint. His daughter's name is Hero, which is...
Oh, that's unusual.
Nice.
As a woman's name.
Mm. And also his niece is called Beatrice.
Not Beatrice, Beatrice.
Well, it could be Beatrice.
Oh, am I just being confused by an Australian accent here then rather than Shakespeare's text?
Yes, there's a big possible. I would say Beatrice because you also say Beatrice but you say Beatrice, is that right?
No, Beatrice.
Great.
Yeah, okay. I'll probably edit this bit out.
No, carry on. I'm going to say Beatrice from now on so I seem more cultured.
I'm sure Beatrice is right. I'm sure you're right. I apologise. So, objection retracted, Your Honour.
No, I'm going to go with you on this one. So there's a lot of names there. Hopefully I can make this make sense. Often with Shakespeare, it all sort of starts to come together. I've put out six or seven names there. But Beatrice, is what I'm trying to say, is one of our two main characters. When she hears that Benedick is coming, she asks about his health and starts to mock him. Ooh. And when the messenger tells her that Benedick also did very well in battle and is quite a brave guy, she continues to belittle him, leaving the messenger shocked. So she's clearly got a bit of beef with this Benedict guy. And when her uncle Leonardo says, "You must not, sir, mistake my niece. There is a kind of merry war betwixt between Signor Benedick and her. They never meet, but there's a skirmish of wit between them." To which Beatrice responds, "Alas, he gets nothing by that. In our last conflict, 4 of his 5 wits went halting off, and now is the whole man governed with 1. So she...
Ooh,
that's right. He's only got 5 wits. He's got 1 left. Yeah, absolutely.
I assume that like that sort of gif, all the friends sort of gather round in a sort of rap battle kind of what kind of reaction. hands to the face.
Oh, no, she didn't. But she did.
Yeah, but she did. She did.
She did.
Oh, she very
much
did.
She said that 4 of his 5 wits had abandoned him.
Yeah.
So, yeah, she's quite a powerful and fun character because she's often having a go at Benedick and coming up pretty well. And there's a bit of tension, rivalry, or a merry war going on between them. And that's before he's even arrived, so...
Yeah, yeah, she's already getting disses in and he's not on stage yet.
Yeah, he can't defend himself. Don Pedro, that's the good Don, arrives with Benedick and Claudio, as well as his... bad brother, the bad Don John, who despite him starting a war, on the surface, they've made up. But let's just say...
Okay, right.
That Don John is still looking for revenge against his brother. In fact, he describes himself in the play as, quote, a plain-dealing villain. So he's like a twirling mustache kind of guy throughout the play.
Right, yeah. Mm.
I'm the original bad boy.
Yeah, he's wearing a leather jacket.
He's got his foot up, hasn't he? He's leaning against the wall with the foot up.
Yeah. He's probably got those, do you remember those candy cigarettes that look like real cigarettes? Just eating one of those.
I think we did, actually, in the production, I think we did have, because I think I was one of Don, if I remember rightly, I was one of Don John's hoodlums.
Ooh.
Great, I think I know who you might be, because if you're only in a couple of scenes... We'll be talking about those scenes.
Ooh, oh, good. Don Henchman.
I'll bring some deep analysis.
Oh, please do.
To the guy who comes on and says something like, "Milady comes." It's like, what was he thinking at that moment? when Nameless Surf 3 said that, James, can you...
I was dressed as a sailor as well, if I remember rightly. I think we had a naval vibe.
Oh, right.
Was that part of the play, or did you just turn up like that and they rolled with it?
I brought my own costume.
I'm not taking the hat off.
So, did you change a lot of the historical setting? Do you think you're one of those ones where you're like, you know, it's Shakespeare, but you're inside the internet or something really out there?
It wasn't quite so... horrible as that. No. But it wasn't set at the time. I think it was set around Second World War times. So that was kind of what the war that they were talking about would be, the Second World War. So everyone came. Yes, I was in the Navy, and I think Benedick was a flyboy. He was in the RAF. And then I think that's what it was to do with. But still, so these people have been at a battle, actually fighting and killing people, and then they're just popping off home together on from opposite sides.
Yeah, they're like, "Oh, my brother, he's all right.
He's a scallywag."
So, they're dropping by Leonardo's place. He invites his guests to stay for a month, and Benedick and Beatrice, I'm not going to get that right, start bickering and scoring points against each other immediately. And instantly, we know it's going to be a long, long month. Later on, Claudio...
So you pause there as if, like, slap bass should come in to take us to the next scene.
Oh, hang on. later on, Claudio, who's the war hero, confesses to his friend, Benedick, that he's in love with Hero, who is the daughter of their host, Leonardo. Claudio says to Benedick that he'd like to marry her. He even says, "Didst thou note the daughter of Signor Leonardo?" And Benedick isn't encouraging, and he rudely says, "I noted her not, but I looked on her." So nothing worth noting there, which is not very nice.
Yeah, what a diss.
And he's also not very encouraging about the concept of marriage. He's very anti getting into a relationship and falling in love. He's not into it. In fact... Mm. This is what Benedict says the others should do to him if he falls in love and marries. He's like, I'll never get married, and if I do, you should, quote, pick out mine eyes with a ballad maker's pen and hang me up at the door of a brothel house for the sign of blind Cupid. Hang me in a bottle like a cat and shoot at me. Pluck off the bull's horns, set them in my forehead, and let me be vilely painted. And in such great letters as they write, here is good horse to hire. Let them signify under my sign, here you see Benedict, the married man. So he's like, I'll never get married. Wow. And if I do, do all this crazy, crazy stuff to me.
Those are just like Tom Waits lyrics, most of those, aren't they?
Yeah, it was very hard.
Just hang me up outside a brothel and kick my eyes out. Put me in a bottle like a cat.
What was that? Was that normal for the time? Was that one of Shakespeare's classic inventions? Did he coin the phrase, put me in a bottle like a cat?
Yeah, that phrase that we all use every day. Yeah.
We owe so much to Shakespeare, we don't realise that everyday phrases like, put me in a bottle like a cat. Like a cat in aspic, one of our most popular dishes here in the UK.
I think you can get that from Messina, the ice cream. flavour.
I hope this is a case of dramatic irony, and this guy is getting married as hell later in the play, because that would be great.
Well, we've got to put him in.
And then
the
all those things happen. Yeah.
And then and then a series of violent catastrophes occur. Kick my eyes out is also, is that what it said? Was it kick my eyes out?
I think it was prick him out with a pen.
I thought it was kick my eyes out, which is so needlessly violent.
That's incredible. You have to do a lot of kicks before the eyes fall out.
you really do.
And you've got to have very, like, maybe those sort of pointy shoes, like Prince.
Well, that's
shoes.
What they wore in those days. They had those sort of those curly-toed shoes with the curl at the end. That's what the curl was for. The little
it was for pricking out the eyes.
It was for kicking out someone's eyes. Yeah.
Of silly husbands.
So his friend Claudio's just confessed he's in love with Hera, and he's gone, I'll tell you about love. I've just talked about how awful it is. So anyway, but someone who is keen on the marriage is their friend Don Pedro. That's the good Don, who encourages his man Claudio to go for Hera. But Claudio is nervous, so Don Pedro proposes that at the masquerade ball that night, he will dress as Claudio and declare his love for Hera. And also, put in a good word with her father, Leonardo. That's the end of Act 1. I know there's a fair few things going on there setting it all up. But to recap, Benedict and Beatrice love to quarrel. That's important. Mm-hmm. Claudio is keen on Hera, the daughter of their host, Leonardo. And Don Pedro says, I'll get you guys together. I'll pretend to be you at the ball.
In classic Shakespeare style, Don Pedro goes, I think I can simplify this situation a little bit by needlessly dressing up as you.
I'll be
pretending
you.
To be you at the ball. Yeah, I'll just dress as you. So that should smooth things out a little.
Normally, the advice for someone in that situation is just be yourself. Whereas this is, I'm going to be you.
So that's the plan. Then Act 2 takes place before and during the masquerade ball. In the first scene...
There's not a masked ball. This is going to be chaos. Yeah,
it is.
Don't remember this bit. Pretty sure I wasn't in it.
You're just out the back smoking or something.
Yeah, absolutely. It was an outdoor production.
Was it?
Oh, yeah. It was in Oxford as well.
Wow.
Yeah, we did the Immortal Bard in the City of Dreaming Spires. It was coming across very charismatic, right?
I wish I'd seen it.
I didn't realise how cultured you were.
Oh, big time.
So, Act 2, we're at the masquerade ball just beforehand, and in the first scene, Beatrice talks to Hera about finding the perfect man, which she says is impossible. She says he'd have to be halfway between the silent Don John, who doesn't speak enough, and Benedict, who talks too much. She's like, impossible to find someone who's like that.
Just some kind of Goldilocks. Do you need someone who talks just the right amount? I would have thought between not talking at all and talking constantly, that's most people, actually.
That's right.
It would be a bell curve. Actually, Beatrice, I'm sorry, you're wrong. Most people would fall in that area.
I totally agree. She's just taken two very extremes and gone,
yeah.
Well, I guess that's all men, one or the other.
It's nice that a podcast of three guys can finally tell the ladies where they've been going wrong.
That's right, come
Your
on.
Standards are too high. Yeah.
Listen to us. I'll pretend to be you. I'll talk to the guy for you. So, like Benedict, she's resolved herself to stay single forever. Watch this space. Okay, both of them saying, I'll be single forever.
Mm-hmm.
At the party, all the men wear masks, and conveniently, no one is able to tell who they are at all. There's no other context clues whatsoever. I'm not sure if they're wearing full balaclavas or elaborate costumes like Toadie from The Masked Singer. I'm not sure.
They've all got lifts on, so they're all the same yeah. height.
That's great. So this scene is actually pretty chaotic because we hear a few breakaway conversations as everyone dances and mingles together. So we have a little bit of these people talking, a little bit of this. Beatrice speaks to Benedict. Remember, they're the ones that often quarrel and take shots at each other. She either not realizes or pretends that she doesn't know who he is and starts speaking about how annoying she finds Benedict.
She knows what
she's
doing.
The one place I wouldn't
doing.
Open with that is in a masked ball.
That's right.
That's yeah. I would be a little bit cautious.
Yeah, I don't know who anyone is. This man, I'll talk to him about one of the people here. We'll see how it goes. And would you believe it, Benedict, he's not happy about this, and he fumes for the rest of the night. He's furious that she had a go at him to his face without realizing it was him. And remember that Claudio was in love with Hero but was too afraid to tell her, and that good Don Pedro would pretend to be him and put in a good word? Well, now's the perfect chance. He's got the mask on.
Mm-hmm.
But the evil Don John.
Oh, no.
I hate that guy.
Yes, that
original bad boy.
The dastardly Don John also sees this as a perfect opportunity to stir up trouble for his brother and friends. Remember, he just tried to rebel against this guy, and now he's trying to get back at him.
Surely they'd be able to tell it was him because of the matchstick in his mouth.
No, that's the thing, that they're all wearing stilts and they all have to have a matchstick in their mouths just to make them all.
But surely the flipping of a coin now and again would tell people. And the louche leaning against a fast car would be a little of an indication. Now, this guy's a bad boy.
Oh, this is a real bad boy.
Yeah, when he gets his bottle of soda pop, he bites the cap off.
He's probably rude to the guy serving malts in the diner.
Absolutely.
He'd be like, hey, Pops. The guy's name isn't Pops. He just doesn't find out what his name is.
He's just a little bit older. He's just 30.
Come on. He's 30. He probably fought in World War II. Show some respect.
So that's Don John. He's looking for a way to get back. And he sees Claudio and pretends to think that when he's speaking to Claudio, that he's Benedict. Benedict, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
He tells Benedict, which is actually Claudio. Remember, he's pretending that he's speaking to Benedict, but he's actually talking to Claudio.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that he's heard that Don John has decided to actually hit on Hero for himself, and rather than put in a good word for Claudio, plans to marry her himself tonight. And he's saying this to Claudio, who is the man in love with Hero.
So, wait a minute. Don John's pretending to be Benedict.
No, he's pretending that Claudio is Benedict. He's like, yo, Benedict, I can't believe that. Have you heard? Don Pedro's going to marry Hero tonight and screw over Claudio. And Claudio's like, I'm Claudio. I haven't heard that at all.
The reason this would be easier to follow as a play is that it's easy to tell who people are under masks, ball masks.
Yes, you, absolutely. It is easy to tell.
It's easy to follow because the whole premise of the scene is nonsense, and you can easily tell who everybody is when they wear those masks. Mm.
Yeah,
and especially when one's wearing a leather jacket.
Yeah.
So basically, he's accidentally, quote unquote, leaked information to Claudio that Don Pedro is going to screw him over and hit on the woman that he loves. So this upsets Claudio, who thinks his friend has betrayed him, and he rushes out of the party, which is an early example of how rash Claudio is when he hears bad news. He doesn't question it. He goes, oh, that's what's happening. The world is against me.
But the plot of every Shakespeare play would fall apart if somebody got some really bad news and then went, I'm just going to wait 30 minutes before acting
exactly.
on that.
Yeah. Are they actually
just in
dead?
Case another messenger arrives.
Yeah.
Probably won't take my life just yet.
So he's furious at Don Pedro because he thinks that Don Pedro is hitting on Hero rather than confessing Claudio's love. But when he comes back into the party, Don Pedro himself comes over and tells him, hey, bud, it's all good. I put in a word with Hero and she's keen to marry you. Everything's fine. So Don John's dastardly plan to break them up, it's failed.
Oh, that's quite quick.
So that don't worry about that anymore. But they won't be married for another week, which they complain is ages to wait. These people have obviously never got a save a date for a wedding in 3 years' time. So they're like, oh, gosh, we've got to wait a week. How do you pass the time? Well, by tricking two people into falling in love with each other, of course. That's the fun game they'll play.
It's actually very lockdown, I think. That, you know, they're at a party, everybody's wearing masks, nobody can tell who anybody else is, and they're all like, oh, we had to rearrange our wedding because of this, and we're just gonna basically go nuts and start manipulating people.
Wait a minute. Yeah. Up until the last bit, that was, kind of my experience of lockdown, but what happened around your house?
I've got some friends who really went off the rails during lockdown. Yeah,
we all went through our manipulation phase.
I mean, I'm there bottling cats, but I don't know about the other bit.
Some people did sourdough, not James.
So they're like, let's come up with a game. Don Pedro proposes a game to trick Beatrice and Benedict, who usually hate each other, into falling in love. Claudio agrees to help, as does Beatrice's uncle, Leonardo, and her cousin, Hero. So everyone's like, yeah, this should be fun. We sort of ruin their lives a little bit.
They clearly hate each other.
Let's see if we can make them fall in love. Meanwhile, the self-described villain of the piece, Don John, is annoyed that his plan to break up the love of Claudio and Hero didn't work out, but he isn't going to give up that easily.
Who's he talking to in this scene?
Well, I think he's talking to one of his followers, which could have been you.
Go on.
But I think this is more... There's two followers. This is the main follower. So tell me if you were cast as Baracchio.
Maybe I remember it because I had to say it. Did the other one have a name even?
Yes, I will get to the other one. Let me see. Conrad? Does that ring your bell?
I think I might have been Conrad.
You were Conrad?
Yeah, basically the smallest part in the play, I think you're fine.
There's no small character, or there's no small part, only small actors. Is that right? Is that the same?
Yeah, I think it's someone like that. Yeah.
I'm sure you would have been
great.
But
this part seems like it's very, very far away.
Yeah.
It may not actually be small, but...
Mostly in a different play. But I remember seeing two people have this conversation very close whilst dressed as naval officers.
and then they're like, Conrad, my sword. And you went, passed the sword over.
Tripped over.
What I think people really appreciated was all the mime you were doing during this scene, just upstaging them in the background. And reacting.
Ooh.
The whole time. The director could not control you.
Just coming in on scenes you're not in, but not saying anything. They technically can't touch you if you do that.
Yeah, I mean, the line's not written.
Yeah, it doesn't say that Conrad wasn't trapped in a glass box during the wedding scene.
He was picking up this. He'd forgotten his invisible rope, and he had to come in and pick it back up.
In every scene.
It was a long rope.
So, Don John, a.k.a. your boss, is pissed because his plan to ruin everything failed. So, one of his followers, one of your colleagues, Baracchio, comes up with an even more sinister plan and proposes it to Don John. The plan is to make it look like Hero is unfaithful to her betrothed Claudio by setting them up to look like that Hero is having an affair. And the way Boracchio says that he'll do this is he'll hook up with Margaret, who is one of Hero's attendants, and Margaret's also his lover, and he will make out with Margaret in Hero's window whilst they set it up so that Claudio and Don Pedro happen to see the liaison from below. And all of this will take place the night before the wedding to make it extra evil.
So it's an evil plan that involves him making out with... Maidservants are always a problem, in my experience. Maidservants are classic stirrers and very easily turned to the purposes of a villain or malcontent, from my observation. You want to watch them.
Well, this one has absolutely been turned to the dark side. Or, to be honest, I think she's tricked. She doesn't realise. She just thinks, we'll make out in the window, but really...
Make out on the window seat? Okay, let's go.
But the strange part is, so apparently she's innocent, but she's also, to make it look more legit, Boracchio gets her to call him Claudio, and he calls her Hero. But I guess that he just explains that it's like a fun game to pretend to be other people or something.
Yeah.
Bit of role play, maybe, I don't know.
I think he also suggests that Conrad is there behind the window, just sort of reinforcing the fact that there is a window there. Just touching the window as much as possible. Otherwise, they wouldn't know.
They wouldn't know.
Exactly.
So that's the plan. An evil Don John tells Boracchio he'll get him tons of cash if it succeeds.
I like the way Don John, having failed at sort of rebellion and war, goes, what if I were just a real stirrer? What if I really tried to mess people over on a personal level with no obvious goal in mind other than causing chaos?
Yeah.
Do you think that's what Saddam Hussein was getting up to before they found him?
What?
Just I'm thinking of someone famous in a while war he was in who that lost hole. A war, and then there was a bit of time between losing the war and then being found in the hole. Do you think he was just, messing up people's relationships?
Yes.
That might be a bit much.
Picking up people's phone and sending texts from their phone.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. Oh, sorry, classic, that was meant for
classic
Karen.
Saddam Hussein.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Meanwhile, Benedict is walking around the grounds wondering how love seems to turn all men into fools and how he'll probably never fall in love.
This guy does not turn it off. It's like we're already in on the scene. He's like, you know what? I was just thinking the thing I said before again.
Yeah. And he's just yelling it out loud.
Ah, a pretty sparrow. Don't get it. Don't fall in love, sparrow. Not worth it. I never would, for example.
And then he's just bragging about how he'll never fall in love. Classic. Classic Benedict. Then enter Don Pedro, Claudio, and Leonardo, who start talking loudly about Benedict, who hides to listen in on their conversation. They totally know he's listening, and they start talking about how Beatrice, the one he always bickers with, is totally secretly in love with him. And he's like, what? They talk how she's head over heels in love with him, but could never admit it to him herself, as he'd probably make fun of her, but that she's being driven insane with secret passion, and the group are actually worried about her. They also talk her up and how Benedict would be a fool to turn her down as a partner because she's awesome. So they're really, really trying to get him to fall in love with her.
Yeah. They're really, really putting the cat in the bottle there.
I appreciated you doing an audio double take when you were impersonating, but you're like, whoa, whoa, what? Yeah. Which is how you do a double take on a podcast.
Absolutely. So they leave, and it seems like their little plan to trick him has worked. He wonders, why would Leonardo lie? He's a trustworthy old man, which is a good question. Yeah, yeah. It really is. Why would he lie about his niece being in love with this man? Anyway, he is lying. But Benedict says out loud, this is basically to cover himself because he said, I'd never fall in love. Then he says, when I said I would die a bachelor, I did not think I should live till I were married.
What?
He's like, actually, if I'm going to live, then I might fall in love. But I just didn't think I was going to fall in love. So technically, when I said that before, I wasn't wrong. I just thought I was going to die.
Like this, I can't believe this guy.
Then Beatrice herself arrives to tell him that dinner is ready. She is her usual self and mocks him. But when she leaves, he decides there must have been a hidden message in her mocking. And he's like, yeah, she is in love with me. I get it. And he decides to take pity on her, saying, quote, if I do not take pity of her, I am a villain. So part one of the plan has worked. Benedict is now interested in Beatrice.
Well, I was just sort of thinking, we're kind of looking at maybe sort of the morality of two different sides. If it's for a good end, is it okay to manipulate people because they might end up with a happy marriage? But then you've got the Don John, if for a bad end, he's trying to manipulate people. I'm really digging into the work here.
And
that's the type of analysis that only someone who has been in this play would really get.
Been in the background of this play, walking into a wind, yes.
So in Act 3, the other half of the plan is put into practice. Hero makes sure Beatrice overhears her talking how Benedict is in love with Beatrice, but that Benedict is too proud to tell her because she'd mock him, and instead he'll just have to waste away in secret. She also talks up how good Benedict is, and also does a bit of psychology where she compliments Beatrice. She's like, surely a woman of Beatrice's intelligence would be smart enough to realize how good Benedict is. And again, it's a success. Beatrice believes it to be true and decides that she could take pity on the man who's not so bad really, and she could make herself love him back. So now they're both interested. Plan's coming together. The other plan that's coming together is Don John's evil plan of destroying Hero and Claudio's marriage by approaching Claudio and Don Pedro and telling them that Hero is unfaithful and that he can prove it. All the men have to do is come with him tonight and watch Hero's window, and they'll see a woman who looks like her from afar making love to another man. They're like, but you can't go too close. You can't go too close.
No, it's just up to that line I've done in the sand, just there.
Yeah. No. Yeah, don't put your glasses on. It's all good.
And look at that other guy. What's that other guy doing? He's really reacting. Yeah. Look at the other guy reacting to that going on.
And let's not forget, this is the night before the wedding. And Claudio, who is again very quick to believe Don John, says that if it's true and he sees his bride-to-be with another man the night before the wedding, he will wait until the next day and at the wedding disgrace her publicly. That's what he says.
Claudio, he may be a great soldier, but he's not the sharpest sword in the armory, is he? It's just like, whatever the latest thing someone told me, I believe that.
He just goes, yep, I guess you're telling the truth. Then we get to a very pivotal scene here with two great characters. We've got Baracchio and also Conrad.
Here he is.
There he is.
The audience is all perked up there. the main good boy, Conrad,
started
on stage.
Applauding like when Kramer arrives on Seinfeld. It's just like, finally.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There he is. That was exactly how I entered every scene. Yeah.
Invisible door.
I entered as if pursued by a bear.
Fantastic.
That's an excellent Shakespeare joke.
That's great stuff. That was great stuff.
The Just rest assured that was everyone.
So, in another scene, Baracchio and Conrad, who is another of Don John's right-hand men, discuss how their plan to make it look like Hero was unfaithful went perfectly. So we don't actually see that. We just hear them talking.
What? They skip over the key scene and they just go like, oh, that was... I hate the way in Shakespeare that all the exciting stuff is just like, wow, wasn't it amazing when we saw that thing that would be really yeah, expensive and cool to stage? Wow. Ah, oh, you should have seen it.
When I saw that amazing ghost, it was so
real.
I'll
now describe it in blank verse. Come on. Come on, Shakespeare.
So he says, Baracchio got with Margaret, the maid, dressed in Hero's clothing whilst Claudio and Don Pedro watched on. And now Claudio's convinced that Hero has cheated on him and will humiliate her at their wedding tomorrow. And they're talking,
don't do it, Claudio.
Talking about this out loud. But one thing Baracchio and Conrad don't realize is that there are people listening in on and noting their conversation.
It's such a stretch every time. Every single time someone notes something. Yeah. It's such a stretch.
Much ado about noting, everyone. Let's not forget.
It'll be texts nowadays. That's probably what the modern versions do. It'd be they'd be texting each other about it.
Much ado about SMSing. Although you'd read that as something, so it'd just make you sound German.
Much ado about something. So someone's listening in on their conversation, and not just anyone, but bumbling watchmen who are sort of police officer types, and they arrest and charge Baracchio and Conrad in the name of the prince for committing conspiracy.
Well, just for being seen making notes. Why were they arrested for conspiracy?
There's a war on.
Oh, because they've just...
there's a war on.
Oh, and they've just talked about how, hey, we set it up to make it look like that... happened.
Sorry, I just got confused. I thought the people who were doing the noting were arrested, but no.
But they noted what they did and said, hang on, that sounds like something I should arrest you for. So they arrest Baracchio and everyone's favourite character, Conrad. Sorry.
Free Conrad.
Yeah. What was good about Conrad, when you arrest him, you don't really need to put him... in a real set. they can bring all the illusions that they've been put in a glass cage.
So the head of the watchmen, a man unfortunately named Dogberry. Which is the best.
Surely that's a euphemism for, you know, like a winner,
a dog Todd,
say in the northeast. But I assume whatever you are saying means the same thing as what I think a dogberry is.
I think, come on, it's Shakespeare.
A hanger on.
He meant that.
Yeah, he knew what he was doing.
Yeah, a Klingon.
Yes. Surely.
So that is Dogberry. Everyone's second favourite character after Conrad.
It's just such a shame that they appear in a scene together and that one actor couldn't play both parts. Yeah, that's the only
absolutely
problem.
Right.
I really wanted Dogberry. It's the best part. It's funniest.
Well, he finds Leonardo to tell him about how the two men have been arrested. But the thing is, Dogberry comes to him on the day of his daughter's wedding. Godfather style, absolutely.
Godfather style.
Yeah, that's only...
it's just an obligatory noise that you have to make in these situations. if anything, Marlon Brando was to mumbling what you were to miming, James.
The master mumbler.
He could mumble in any scene, in any situation. He could mumble the whole world.
You're doing Shakespeare and Marlon Brando turns up and starts mumbling. You're not going to tell him to leave.
You are not.
Yeah. You got to sell your tickets. Yeah, that's... even if he hasn't got any trousers on, famously.
So Dogberry turns up to tell Leonardo, hey, it's all been a conspiracy. Your daughter has been framed, all this sort of stuff. But the way he tells the story is so comically drawn out and ridiculous that Leonardo dismisses him and says, hey, can we talk about this later? He tells them to interview the men they've arrested themselves and he'll talk to them after the wedding.
No!
Oh, no. So the wedding goes ahead in Act 4 for a bit. But it's pretty quick. It's about 3 lines of dialogue. But when the priest, Friar Francis, asks for any objection, the groom, Claudius himself, jumps in. You don't often hear people objecting at their own wedding. He asks Leonardo if he gives his daughter Hero over to him. And Claudius responds, "There, Leonardo, take her back again. Give not this rotten orange to your friend." So he's like...
And he's played by Marlon Brando. So orange is probably, as the Godfather, that's probably quite triggering for him.
Yeah, that's not a good sign. Yeah. Not a good sign of death. But I love that. He's like, "Do you give your daughter to me?" And Leonardo's like, "Of course." And he goes, "Take her back." So it seems unnecessary.
It's very reality TV. Yeah.
It's an elaborate, like walk in to the burn. Mm. Like, you had to really walk them in a certain path in order to get the specific burn back to them.
Yeah. You've thought of only one way to say it, so you really need them to play along perfectly.
Yeah.
Just gotta hope I get the feed line I need here.
Yeah. So do you give me your daughter then? Well, you know, it's her own choice. Yeah, but do you, as the father, do you give her to me? Would you say that? Would you say it right now, please? Just say it.
Say it in a sentence.
Okay, all right. You want me to say I give you your daughter? Yeah, but say it as if it was your own thought. Yes, I give you my daughter. Well, take her back then. Get out of town. Have a rotten apple. Get out of here. That's Shakespeare. See, that's how you riff Shakespeare.
Yeah. That's good stuff. Hey, that's the beauty of, if you're in the background of a lot of scenes, you observe more than most people do. So you get the subtext. Yeah. More than even the Leonardo himself. You're getting it. Love that. So he says, "Take her back." And then Claudio goes on and on about how he knows that Hero isn't a virgin and in fact was unfaithful the night before the wedding, and her father, Leonardo, is shocked. But Don Pedro, who was also tricked...
So I am shocked to receive this information for the second time, yeah. But be listening this time. Wow.
What? Yeah. But Don Pedro...
This is like one of the first 2 times I'm hearing about this.
Yeah, oh my gosh. This sounds very familiar.
Not this again.
Yeah. But he doesn't really believe it. But Don Pedro, who was also tricked into seeing the fake affair, testifies that Claudio, he's like, yeah, he's telling the truth. And then Leonardo dramatically asks for a dagger to stab himself. So.
Oh, whoa.
Okay.
Bit
all right.
Much.
Yeah.
We were all having a laugh.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just
got a bit serious.
Joking about the rotten orange, mate. Calm down.
But Hero herself, she's up at the wedding, and she denies the charge and then faints from shock, goes down. Mm. At that point, Claudio, Don Pedro, and the evil Don John leave the wedding. Beatrice runs to give the unconscious Hero aid, but her father says, "Let her go. Dying would be better than living this life of shame." Which is, again, very, very dramatic.
Whoa, yeah.
Beatrice doesn't believe what she's heard, and neither does the priest Friar Francis, who thinks Hero is telling the truth based on the shock he saw on her face. He's like, she wasn't lying. This is the first time she's heard this information. He's like, I can read people real good.
Yeah, as a priest, she was telling the truth.
Yeah, as a priest, I see a lot of lie. So... Hero actually comes to. She just fainted rather than died like her father thought. And she denies everything that's been said about her. And the friar comes up with a plan. Leonardo, the father, should pretend his daughter is dead, having died of shock at the altar. And whilst she's in hiding, they should run a little investigation into what really happened. And if Hero turns out to be was unfaithful, everyone will think she's dead and she can be quietly shipped off somewhere overseas. But if she's telling the truth, they've find out that she's innocent. So everyone, including her father, Leonardo, agrees to the plan. They'll pretend she's dead and try and get to the bottom of the matter. Benedick immediately suspects that the evil Don John could be behind the deception.
because there's one guy they've been hanging out with who's evil.
Yeah.
So maybe it was him.
In the whole scene, he was like doing evil laughter just over the top of the whole
thing. And as soon as she died, they just sort of dusted their hands off and left.
Yeah. He's either applying anti-back to his hands there, or he's been up to something.
Later in the scene, Beatrice and Benedick are alone, and they confess their love for each other, which, remember, is the result of a trick. But they're both kind of feeling it now. They sort of convinced themselves that they actually like the other one.
I think the vibes were there from the start.
Mm. Yeah, it was a bit of a love-hate relationship going on, yep.
I think, to coin a phrase, I think they did protest too much.
Yeah, that's really good, James. You should write that down.
Is that one of yours?
Write that down. Yeah, that's one. That's an original
Shake Shaft.
classic William Shake Shaft.
Yeah. Gilliam Shake Shaft.
Yeah.
Your nom de plume.
Mm.
So they've confessed their love, and Benedick wants to prove himself and how much he loves Beatrice. And he says, "I'll do anything." And she says, "All right, how about you kill your friend Claudio for leaving Hero at the altar and ruining her life and reputation?" And he's like, "Ooh. Oh, no, not that.
She's loyal.
I'll do anything, but not that."
She's he's meatloaf the situation. Anything. I can't believe that.
But he's like, "I'll do something else." But Beatrice responds, "I guess you don't love me." And then eventually Benedict agrees, "All right, fine, I'll challenge Claudio for dishonoring Hero. I'll prove it. Whatever."
Mm. Like, you sure you wouldn't take a cat in a bottle instead? Okay, all right.
And with that, we come to the final act, Act 5. Mm. At the start of the act, Leonardo, the father, is having a full breakdown. He's not sure if his daughter has been framed, as she claims, or has indeed lied to him and everyone. He's freaking out. He challenges Claudio to a duel for the things he said about his daughter, which resulted in her death. Remember, Claudio and Don Pedro think she's dead.
Mm.
So he challenges Claudio. Claudio tries to ignore the old man's challenge, but Leonardo swears revenge.
Get in line, Leonardo. Everyone's dueling.
That's right. Enter Benedict, who also challenges Claudio to a duel to the death. So
we got a dual,
it's like the
Spider-Man
meme.
Yeah.
with swords.
It totally is. Because at first they think that Benedict's mucking around, you know, because he's a pretty silly kind of guy. But they soon realize, oh no, he's serious, and he's motivated by his love for Beatrice. And I wonder if at this point they're starting to regret tricking him into falling in love with her as a joke, because now he's trying to murder his friends.
And also probably thinking they might have might want to reassess Beatrice's personality.
Yeah.
If she's just like, oh, someone's in love with me. What could I get them to do to prove that love? I got it, moida. Yeah.
This is like one of those films you show, like if someone in class has been taking notes and you want to show them the dangers that taking notes can lead to, it's like, well, actually, kids, we've got a film for you. These hot Italian teens thought that taking notes was fun and games. And look what happened.
Thought that playing Cupid didn't have consequences. But now we got ten cats in bottles here. And these guys are about to kill each other.
We've got a 9-way duel going on.
Benedict also tells Don Pedro that his brother Don John has disappeared and left the city, which is a bit suspicious, wouldn't you say?
Mm. Yeah.
Did he go out on his hot rod?
Yeah, he revved it the whole way.
That's my impression.
It's like grease lightning.
Wow. Devil's Needle. Or it would probably be called something like that. Or Dead Man's Curve. Just drive a different way, kids. I've got so many lessons for the teens today. Yeah, I'll name it more safely.
Yeah.
More like, watch it. Watch it, Curve.
Yeah. Take it steady corner.
Well, then enter Dogberry and his bumbling mates from the Watch, who arrested Baracchio and Conrad, and they actually drag in Baracchio and Conrad. So you're back on stage, James.
This is genuinely the only scene I actually remember.
Oh, really?
What? So this is because they don't have a prison, so they have to just bring the prisoners around with them as they go to keep an eye on them.
It's a strange system.
Hey, it worked for them.
That's right. They're great watchmen. They really they watch the men at all times.
Mm.
Dogberry explains that they've interrogated the villains and that they've admitted to setting up the whole affair. So they've explained, it's a big reveal to everyone. They're like, oh.
So he just explains it, but more quickly this time than the last time he tried to explain it when it actually would have been helpful. Yep. Okay. Thanks, Dogberry.
Claudio and Don Pedro are especially gobsmacked and they're upset because they think that Hero is dead because of the false accusations they publicly leveled at her wedding. So they're feeling really bad.
Yep, I'm rightly so. And, really?
And let's not forget the words of Britannica. The play takes an ancient theme, that of a woman falsely accused of unfaithfulness, to brilliant comedic heights. So Hero's father, Leonardo, comes back in to see the man that framed his daughter. He sees Baracchio and Conrad. Claudio and Don Pedro beg for his forgiveness and ask Leonardo to decide Claudio's punishment as revenge. And Leonardo asks Claudio to tell Messina, which is the city, of his daughter's innocence, write her epitaph, and to sing it to her bones at her tomb. So that's cool. What he says. And then he says, quote, "And since you could not be my son-in-law, be yet my nephew. My brother hath a daughter, almost the copy of my child that's dead." So he says to Claudio, "Marry my niece instead. That's part of the punishment."
Okay. How bad is this niece?
Yeah. That's what you'd be wondering, wouldn't it? But Claudio breaks down and thanks his almost father-in-law, probably because, unlike other Shakespeare plays, he didn't pluck out his eyes or bake him into a pie or something. He's like, "All right, write an epitaph and marry my niece. Go on." That's it. So cut to the final scene. We're back at the church for Claudio's second wedding. Yay.
Yeah.
Mm. They probably reused a lot of the flowers.
Yeah, I reckon. Yeah. That's
just put a little sticker on the invitation to change the date.
Yeah, I imagine the guests just extended their hotel bookings. Yeah. They're not happy about it, but they're there.
Benedict is there and stoked that he didn't have to fight his friend Claudio to the death in a duel. Benedict asks Leonardo for his permission to marry his niece, Beatrice, and Leonardo says yes. And whilst waiting for the bride to arrive, Benedict's friends tease him for being in love with Beatrice, because remember, he's the man who said he'd never marry anyone. And now he's engaged. But they don't pluck out his eyes with a pen. They don't.
They don't do any of that stuff that he specifically said that they should do.
Which I think is ridiculous.
What happened to male friendship?
Exactly.
That's what I want to know. This is going to be a really violent stag do, obviously. It's going to be nightmarish.
At this time, it's the women's turn to wear veils that hide their identity, and the bride arrives, and Claudio thinks she is Leonardo's unnamed niece that he's just agreed to marry.
Unnamed? Oh, not even named the niece?
Doesn't know. Yeah, he's like, "Oh, all right, hello, niece. Nice to meet you. I'm going to be your husband in 5 minutes. But she pulls off her mask to reveal that it's Hero all along.
Whoa. That must have been quite shocking.
A shock revelation to like one guy in the scene and everybody else knows this already.
That's right. Everyone knew she was alive except him. And he's like, what the heck? She's been alive this whole time and agreed to marry the man who only yesterday said those awful things about her at their first wedding, but now they're at their second wedding.
That was kind of a first wedding thing. I don't think he's going to repeat that.
But do you give her to me? Do you give her to me? Just want you to... Yeah.
Then Benedict stands up and asks, which of the veiled ladies is Beatrice? And then when Beatrice reveals herself, he asks, do you love me? And she says, why? No more than reason, which is super romantic. And then,
that is Prince Charles level romance.
So does she likes reason then? Is that?
Yeah. She loves reason.
So it's been established that she loves reason. Yeah, you know, I love reason.
That was the name of her first love, who died horribly at the age of 15, sadly.
On Dead Man's Curve.
Dead Man's Curve. Yeah. It's dangerous out there.
So I got the name.
Yep.
And Benedict's like, but your uncle and the prince, they said you love me. They swore you did. And she says, well, do you not love me? And he says, well, no more than reason. And she's like, but your cousin, Margaret, and everyone, they said that you love me. They swore you did. And Benedict says, well, they swore you were almost sick for me. And she says, well, they swore that you were well nigh dead for me. And they're sort of going back and forth. It looks like they've figured out the whole thing. They're not going to get married until each of the party's friends pull out a bit of poetry that they wrote about each other. And they discover, hang on, they are actually in love.
Oh, so even we didn't know that. They were in love all along.
Well, maybe, but then these are the people themselves saying, I'm not in love, but everyone's like, I've got it on a bit of paper. You have to marry him now. You wrote poetry about him.
It looks like someone wrote a note.
Yes. It's exactly.
I didn't really think that through. Looks like, once again, notes, a very good pun, have become relevant to this play.
Perfect. So they continue to bicker about saving each other's life because I heard the other one was in love with the other one until Benedict says, peace. I will stop your mouth. And then he kisses her to basically end the conversation and stop her talking. And then everyone starts dancing.
Is it one of them sort of big, big mouth kisses, though, where sometimes you see when someone doesn't really know how to kiss and they do like over the top, mouth over the other one. Like
he's bobbing for apples on her lips.
Yeah. That's a weird kiss, mate.
The dance is very Bollywood, but the massive mouthy kiss you're describing, James, is very un-Bollywood.
So everyone's dancing. All seems well until a messenger enters, and the messenger says, my lord, your brother John is taken in flight and brought with him armed men back to Messina. And Benedict responds...
Oh, I bet we're going to see that on stage. Yeah. We're not. It's just being described. Yeah. Oh, okay, fine.
And Benedict responds with...
They're riding on elephants. They've got a Wurlitzer, yeah. But you can't see any of it.
They've all got matchsticks in their mouths.
It's the army of bad boys.
Think not on him until tomorrow. I'll devise the brave punishments for him. Strike up, pipers. He says to like the people playing music. And that's the end of the play. I guess we'll find out what happens in the sequel. Much ado about nothing.
So they're like, oh, the soldier at the gates. And he goes like, no time for that. We got to party down. Exactly. And then just the DJ comes on.
Yeah. It's like.
And everyone just disco down. And a disco ball lowers into frame. Yeah, and they're
exactly.
Like, and okay.
It's such a strange ending. It's like, yeah, they're here to kill the whole city. Whatever. We're dancing. And then that's it.
I said we're going to party.
Yeah. It's an incredible
finish. Sounds like one of those ones where the credits would be the actors, their name would be on screen as each actor sort of danced and winked at camera.
Absolutely.
As it goes through each
other.
And there was Leonardo.
Shot by a shotgun.
as soldiers lay siege to the town behind them.
And that's the end of the play. James, or should I say Conrad, how much of that came back to you as I was talking about it?
Genuinely, just the bit where the Dogberry brings the people on, I remember that bit. And beforehand, we had to interact with the audience before the play started. It was pretty horrible.
Like in character. But you have to do that thing where you try and announce people to turn off their mobile phones while simultaneously pretending you don't know what a mobile phone is. One of those sort of things.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Prithee, ladies and gentlemen, take thine pocket tablets and switcheth them, I pray. To airplane mode?
To eagle, mechanical eagle mode. It means airplane mode.
Fain. Disturbeth you not in do not disturb mode. I don't know.
This is very good Shakespeare riffing.
Thank
by
you.
By the way, next time I have that anxiety dream, I'll just call on you.
Alistair, thoughts? What do you think of Much Ado About Noting?
Well, yeah, I mean, there was a lot of ado You can't take that away from Shakespeare. Yeah. He crammed a lot of ado into this play. I think it's quite good. I don't really like his comedies that much. I think this is better than Midsummer Night's Dream. I'll say that much.
Okay.
I think it's good. Have I upset you there, James?
frankly. No, I think it's got more like the comedy potential in Midsummer Night's Dream. Though the play rehearsal set piece in Midsummer Night's Dream is a very funny bit.
You like that because it's got a guy miming pretending to be a wall. That's why you
exactly. Yeah, my
and
part,
then somebody else pretending to be a hole in a wall that and yes. trying to mime and that.
Someone tried pretending to be the man in the moon.
Yeah,
and his dog
and his lantern, I think.
Yeah, this is my lantern and this is my dog. That's a very funny scene. Anyway, there's no... I mean, Dogberry, I think, is your comic... Your role for the clown in this one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he has his sort of silly scene of trying to speak and hilariously someone feigns death.
As a result. Just 'cause I'm sick of him talking, is that? I can't remember. Yeah. I think it's good. I'm not sure... The Tempest is... It's not a funny, The Tempest. Is it a comedy?
No, that's one of the much later ones, isn't it? That's sort of.
I like it
because
it's all
really
weird and creepy.
Anything.
It doesn't really. Mm. Yeah. I'm trying to think of a good. I'm trying to think of a good Shakespearean comedy. Which one?
I just think they don't translate. Most of them don't translate anymore.
Well, yeah, I think most of them they translate better when you see them or hear them. Especially the.
I'm not saying
comedies.
Bottom is obviously funny. His name's Bottom.
I mean, that's good writing. Come on.
That is good writing.
That translates.
There's a bit, I think, there's a garden centre in North London where in the toilets they have, you know the way people have sort of nice quotes stenciled on things these days?
Mm.
They have a quote from Midsummer Night's Dream on the mirror, which is something like, "Thou art as beautiful as thou art wise." Which is like a compliment to you, the person looking in the mirror. But the line in Midsummer Night's Dream is spoken by Titania to Bottom while she's under the spell. So it's a gag. She's saying, "You're as beautiful as you are intelligent," but she's speaking to a guy with a donkey for a head who's an idiot. So the point is, you are ugly and stupid.
Yeah.
And he's called Bottom. So I don't know if the people in the garden centre are like, or whether they don't know that they're insulting everybody who reads that quote.
Yeah. I'd love to know if they're in on that. I really hope they are. That would be fantastic.
It's a weird turnaround. It's like the way the Citizen Kane gif of Citizen Kane of Orson Welles clapping furiously. People post that to, under something that they think is good. So they're like, oh, applause. But the whole point of that scene is that the performance that he's clapping is terrible. A really, really, really bad performance. And he's clapping really hard to give the impression that he thought it was good. So every time you use that, you're insulting people.
I will keep that in mind.
And it's very much like every time I give, you know, when I was dating, I would give the girl a cat in a bottle to show my love. invariably it backfired.
Often that wouldn't go down well.
Yeah.
But when it did, that's when you knew they're the one.
Yeah.
Well, the thing that we do at the end of each episode is give the work a score out of 5. Which is always hilarious to give Shakespeare a score out of 5.
Yeah.
Because I have had people in here be like, oh, I didn't like that one. 1.5 for Shakespeare. Which is very, very funny. So no pressure. You can like it. You can hate it. You can give it a middling, mediocre score.
Well, James and I also do scores out of 5 on our podcast, Norman. So we are no stranger to taking our cultural heritage and going,
note, in this one, because you scored the names out of 5, what would you score the names you had Benedict, you had
Benedict's great.
Leonardo.
Dogberry is coming in hot.
Dogberry is very...
Oh, unfortunately, Dogberries are coming in hot.
Two Dons. Kind of confusing, and Don John's not a great bad guy name, as we talk
Don
about.
Don John is such a bad guy name, though. But it's almost so bad it's good. Like Don John, it's like a
Don John,
a The Room quality character name. Yeah. It's really bad.
It's that there's that fruit drink. There's like a fruit juice company called Don Simon.
Don Simon. Which always,
that seems like an under, an, a sort of, yeah, sets itself up, no, and then undercuts
itself. I thought it was wine. Straight away. Is Don Simon not wine?
Oh, I thought it was fruit juice, but maybe that's why I keep getting pulled over whilst driving.
Yeah, you've always thought, it comes from a grape, it's fruit juice.
Yeah, it's fruit juice, right?
It's juice, it's juice, it's juice. It's juice.
It's a juice. Mm. So I've, and what was it, Baracchio?
Baracchio.
And then Conrad.
Conrad, obviously a hero.
Conrad.
I just something about that name.
Yeah. I'm going a hard four because Dogberry is actually, I've genuinely only just got that joke. And as I say, I was in a production of the play and I did not realise it's referring to dog poo.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's a dogberry, isn't it?
A dog's berry, yeah.
Mm.
Oh, well, having only just got that now, I'm going to go higher. I'm going to go five. Because I enjoyed Don John. I'm going to say five.
Yeah, nice one, Shakespeare. Nice one, Shakespeare. You did well with your names. I mean, you know Dickens, but you're good.
And for the play itself, out of five?
Well, it's a three for me, needs more Conrad. slash mime.
Yep, fair enough.
I have to go with James. James is the expert in Much Ado About Nothing. So I'll go with my teammate and say three.
Three out of five. I'm going to go four.
I really enjoyed it. I thought it was good. I think it might be. I think it might be a four.
But you've got to go with your teammate. I understand that.
But I have to side with James. I'm Team Shaft, not Team Spear.
I'm going to give the names a full marks, 5 out of 5. I did enjoy the names, but the play itself, I think I'm going to go slightly more generously. I'm going to give it 3.5 out of 5.
Ooh. Oh, we do half. No, I didn't know you did halves.
Oh, you can't. You can do. Sometimes people give me.
We
a
would
3.
Never
2.
Do a half on Lawmen.
You can't
we
do it. No halves.
No. Otherwise, we'd just rate out of 10. We'd rate it out of 10.
Exactly. We stick to halves. The natural numbers. Thank
right.
You.
Well, I don't want to offend, so I'm going to put mine up to a 4 out of 5. It was good. Okay. It's fun.
It's good.
It's yeah. But it and also, you know, the subtext, you know, is it good to pretend to make people fall in love if you think it's for the best or if you're doing it for nefarious reasons, you know?
Yeah, it's a great question.
Something.
I agree.
That's the subtitle to it. It's Much Ado About Nothing, : or is it good to make people fall in love if you think it will be good or if you're doing it for nefarious reasons or something?
Or something.
And that, just for space, they shortened it.
Or what you will.
Or what you will. That's the subtitle for all of them.
Yeah, make up your own mind.
Well, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Booksheet. Really appreciate you guys dialing in from the other side of the world. Fantastic to have you on.
Thank you. It's
no
been
problems.
Great.
Thanks
lots
for having
fun.
Us.
If people want to hear Lawmen, they can find it on all the podcast apps, I'm presuming.
Yeah, but you have to spell it right. L-O-R-E-M-E-N.
Yeah.
Lorraine. L-O-R-E-M-E-N.
Fantastic.
Yeah, if you want a smart speaker to understand it, you have to call it Lorraine.
Okay, we'll remember that.
Not so smart. Those speakers, no.
Towards the end of last year, Matt Stewart, who I do the other Do Go On podcast with, we're on an episode with you, James, and it's great fun.
Yes.
Great fun.
Yes, we did a Whistle Stop tour ahead of your Whistle Stop tour of the UK.
It was great. And it gave us lots of context what to expect from each of the cities.
Yeah. And I bet you really understood the Glasgow coat of arms after that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It changed everything. And Alistair, your new book, one more time, is called Montgomery Bonbon Murder at the Museum.
Correct. And if you enjoy Shakespeare, it's way better. Way better than Shakespeare. Much sillier names. Shorter. And no masks. No masks.
Okay.
Not in this one.
Fantastic. Well, thank you again for joining me. At the end of each episode, I always say thank you for being on the show, and I always sign off with by yelling, "Books forever!"
Good on.
Yeah, it's weird. It's a weird way to end a podcast.
Hey, Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.